In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Recently, we heard Professor Eric Larson admonish those who have become obediently ignorant and comfortable living in a country that continues to wage multiple illegal wars in the name of its citizens, that continues to strip away civil liberties granted by the U.S. Constitution, that continues to build a surveillance panopticon, vacuuming up emails, phone calls, and personal data of its citizens, that continues to remind you that the repealing of freedoms are necessary for your security and the nation's security. We are now unconsciously living in this new reality created by an irrelevant government inserting itself, trying to take away the power of the people to help one another. A distorted media and essentially a news blackout has been described as the most single powerful weapon used against the people in the United States. These distortions are also necessary for the positioning of athletes, comic book characters, musicians, and celebrities as heroes to praise and idolize, while whistleblowers, the real heroes, have become vilified. Many thoughtful people have pointed out this sick inversion. Among them is our guest, Doug Ault. Doug is an artist who created his own lexicon of heroes, memorialized in oil painting portraits. The project is called Those Who Blew the Whistle, 100 Portraits of Whistleblowers and Informers. Whistleblower is generally defined as someone who informs on a person or organization engaged in an illicit activity. Doug broadens the definition to include informers, not informants, who bring previously unknown and unaccepted information forward that are often suppressed ideas contrary to political, corporate, scientific, and medical consensus. I joined Doug at his home in Hoboken, New Jersey, to talk about this project. Doug, welcome to Another News.
Hi, Jeff, and nice to talk to you today.
Doug, we're in your living room, where on the wall are the whistleblower portraits. How many are in the collection?
I have 100 portraits in this collection, and I ended the series at 100. It's a series that could have gone on and on and on. I could have made 500. And every time I learn about another whistleblower, somehow I learn about another two or three. People write in and inform me also of other people that would be good candidates for my series. Unfortunately, I have to put an end to it somewhere. I chose the number 100. 100 seemed to me to be a substantial enough statement on this. There's such a variety of people in varying spectrums and subjects that take this whole issue on. I wanted to kind of go over a good number of them, but I've mainly, if anybody checks my website and sees my work, they can see that I concentrate my work around UFO, ET, and paranormal topic.
What motivated you to begin this type of project?
Going back into my life, I've always kind of had a child coming out of the 60s and, you know, coming of age in the late 60s and early 70s, we all had a kind of sense of activism in us. I was part of the lottery for the draft for Vietnam War. If I had pulled the wrong lottery number with my birthday, I would have been off over there rather than getting a pass on it. And it seemed kind of strange that a bouncing ball in a lottery system would decide who lived or died, but it's sort of the way it worked. And, 58,000 young Americans my age and a little bit older didn't return from that war, and many that did were terribly maimed and scarred for life. So you had to kind of learn some things quick about speaking up and taking a side and taking a stance on some things, because at that time, you could have been taken away. I remember a guy coming up to me and yelling at me. He's like, do you know what's going on? You're going to be drafted. You're going to be taken from your family and sent to war. And it was like, I almost didn't understand it. I was of that age. And so it made an impression on me. And from there on in, with the culture, the music, the art, and everything that was coming out at the time, we were all very inspired to make a better world. We were all kind of like really interested in moving the ball forward, so to speak, on a better world. And I became interested in art, and I would say portraiture somehow caught my attention most, because there's something in the human face that's always fascinating to me. It just, you know, a little glint of an eye, a raise of an eyebrow, and an expression tells you so much about what somebody's thinking or saying, whether they say it or not. You see it in their face. So I think portraiture in art, when I started going to museums and galleries, I think I always seeked out portraiture for some reason. So what got me going in this was my love of portraiture. But then as time went on, I wanted to do something with the portraiture, and my work has evolved throughout the years on the topic, such as the Burn Survivor series that I did, the faces out of fish that I created, and so on. So it's always been portraits.
The early experience of the Vietnam War and close to being drafted into that war was an initial patterning of an activism for you. But you pointed out that this project, the Whistleblower Project, is primarily in the paranormal realm. That to me is interesting because there is a pretty major crossover of activism and the paranormal. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. I mean, as time evolved after while growing up and sort of digesting the lay of the land, seeing, you know, 9/11 happen, reading about the Project for a New American Century and the people that were determined to get us involved in a military conflict, we had done away with the draft. So a lot of people got the feeling that we didn't have to take part in activism in the same way, because you were either going to volunteer and you were going to go, or you were going to be left out of it. Whereas back then, I didn't have a lot of choice, or we didn't have a lot of choice if you were going to be drafted. But as time went on and my focus changed on different topics, and as I started to dig in deeper to certain topics, I started to get onto this whole idea that there is a phenomena that people are talking about, my senses tell me are real, and yet finding any kind of true evidence to hold it up, tangential evidence, is very difficult. But that was the whole world of the ET question, the paranormal question. Is there life beyond us? Does our government know that? Have we been visited? Have we back-engineered crafts and so on? And that whole topic got my interest. It's always had my interest, but it really got my interest about 10 or 12 years ago, and I started to really concentrate on that.
Was there an incident that occurred that prompted that interest?
I read William Cooper's book called Behold a Pale Horse, and my eyes opened and my jaw dropped. I went, oh my God. I mean, because we're talking about, once you start talking about people who have clearances, who are privy to inside information, and this is the whole thing, with classification, with everything being classified, and everything with the fact that everything is hidden in clearances and so on, government classification, we can only guess, we can only speculate. It's the people on the inside that hold the cards, and they're the ones that can decide who's going to know and who's not going to know. And I'm not part of that game. I can only use my best judgment, my intuition, and create a best working hypothesis about what I believe is happening. After reading that book and getting kicked off into the topic, and then coming across person after person that was testifying, because you start to, it's like dominoes. You learn one name and you jump over to another. And as I went along and started investigating different people, I started to really build a pattern here that there's something going on. There's far too many intelligent, successful people that are seemingly throwing their lives away on something. If it was false, if it was just made up, there had to be some real criteria behind it. And I felt that these people are quite interesting. And that's how I started to get into looking at people in that field. So after coming across William Cooper's book, and starting to have this whole group of people become known to me, and the whole list of whistleblowers start to unravel and link like dominoes. I started to read a little bit about our first Secretary of State, James Forrestal. And James Forrestal was, I think he was thrown out of a hospital window. He allegedly took his life by jumping out a hospital window, but it doesn't add up. And if you start to look into that story, you start to think to yourself, well, what was going on at the time? Evidently, this Eisenhower meeting, the ETs having a meeting at night where on a particular day where they whisked him off. Supposedly, the story was he was going to see a dentist and he was out of communication and no one could find him for like a day. And there's just so much material around this and so many of the researchers speak about this. And it links to the whole idea of maybe Forrestal was one of the people that wanted to out this story, that our government, we were warned to be wary of the military-industrial complex by many through the years. My suspicion was he wanted something outed. Now, I can't prove that, and I don't know how many people could, but for some reason he was marginalized, as the word goes, so...
So he's one of the portraits in your collection here.
Yeah, James Forrestal, first Secretary of Defense, is in my collection, yeah. So, and whenever anyone goes to my collection on my site, there's a little bit of a bio or a link to something that has to do with that portrait. So if you click on the portrait, the larger portrait will come up, and underneath there's a bio. And that bio will jumpstart you into a little bit about that person. And I think that's really what my whistleblower project was intended to do, to take a group of people that are not really known to the average person. We all know movie stars and sports personalities, and we know celebrities, and we know this and that. But we don't know out of, the 100 portraits I painted, maybe a person on the street would know two or three of them. By painting their portrait, I would recontextualize their face into, the framework of art. And art gets you to look, paintings get you to look at a portrait differently than just a photograph. Not to minimize photography as not being art, but there's something about a handmade piece of work that gets you to look, and as you're studying the art of it, and you're asking yourself, well, why did the artist do this, or how did he interpret this face? You're asking yourself, and why did he paint this person in the first place? And that's my segue into the topic of getting onto who these people are. And that's one of the things I hope my site and my work can do.
Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, he was a whistleblower or informer? How did he end up there? I mean, because he was possibly suicided. Mm-hmm.
At the moment, I couldn't tell you exactly what there was other than the fact that I felt, and other researchers felt, well, I'm not a researcher necessarily, but the researchers and people I read about, including Peter Robbins, who's quite a fantastic researcher, he's very fascinated and interested in James Forrestal. And so talking with other people, the theory is that he was somebody that wanted to kind of hold to the people have a right to know kind of thing. And there's what's starting to happen is this whole, like, Majestic 12 and this whole group of people are starting to hold this information. And, any politician that comes in for 4 or 8 years as a president or so on could make a lot of trouble for an organization of lifers in our government who want to hold certain things a certain way. And I think that he was one of the people that maybe paid a price for wanting to change that. And so I couldn't really tell you an exact thing that he said or did, but from what I understand, just him being murdered, in my opinion, had me choose to put him in this series.
Okay, I appreciate you explaining that. Peter Robbins has been a guest on the show a couple times, and it'll be interesting, maybe for me definitely, and maybe listeners, to follow up on Peter's work on James Forrestal.
Absolutely.
Do some digging. Let's go through some of the names of the portraits. There's so many people here, but I think we should just start listing some names.
Okay, well, first of all, we have one of the most obvious, which is President John F. Kennedy. Okay, and I think a lot of people are very well aware with some of his speeches, one of his great speeches, just on the entire idea of secrecy. We're not about, this country should not be about secrecy. You know, a lot of people also feel that he was onto the ET UFO equation.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a very, very talked about issue. He also wanted to have a joint space effort with Russia. And how can you do that if you're trying to keep a Cold War going? It's profitable for our government to keep keep an enemy there all the time. Profitable for a variety of reasons. You have to keep a huge military budget going and all that kind of stuff. So I also have, for example, a guy named Phil Schneider. You know, he worked in underground in tunneling, and he has amazing testimony. He even had half his hand blown off and wounds to show people that he testified to uncovering a group of alien beings underground in the tunnels, which is as crazy a story as somebody's going to hear. But, you know, I one of the things I always ask myself in listening to all these people is, well, what's their motive? I mean, why would you take a perfectly fine life or career and throw it down the toilet by coming up with this kind of stuff?
Phil Schneider was very upset in where a lot of the taxpayer money was going. And how it was funneled into black projects. Certainly not most of the black projects, but state tax, federal tax, the funds that the people in this country earn and their tax money were going into nefarious projects mm-hmm. that actually are designed not for the benefit of humanity.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, he was a person who paid with his life. I mean, they, you know, he was murdered
in a motel room. Found a tubing around his neck.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And he knew it. He knew it was coming. He knew that they were after him. I know this sounds like a great deal of paranoia, but you know, it happened. There's also someone I remember as a young guy. I remember when I was watching the NASA space launches, as Clark McClelland from NASA would come on and speak about. The launch. I just remember his name as being a young guy, and he's I'm pretty sure he's still with us. He lives in Florida. He lives in terrible conditions, and he came out and whistleblew on the idea that he saw in NASA while he was in there. He saw, watching one of the monitors, he saw a large 8 or 9 foot alien being in the cargo bay with the astronauts. Now again, this is Clark McClelland. He's on my site. Anyone can check him out. According to Clark, and he swears to it, he's been on Jeff Rentz and many of the shows many times, he swears to it that this is what is happening, that we have there is life on the moon, and we have, we've been there in different capacities, not in the one told to us, and that there's an entire backstory to this that's absolutely incredible. And again, here's a guy that now, according to Clark, his pension and everything has been taken away from him because he came out and he spoke about something that is taboo.
We are to think that he had listened to his conscience and thought, I can't keep this to myself. This information needs to get out to the public in any way, shape, or form, even if it's just my personal testimony. And maybe my credibility will be seen in the sacrifice that it takes to bring this information out as an employee for NASA.
Yeah, I mean, and it's terribly tragic. The man suffers from diabetes. I think he had a leg removed. He's struggling to stay afloat in his life. I think he lives in a trailer by himself. He lost his wife. I mean, it can get pretty hard and pretty drastic. And I know I've bought a few little bits of memorabilia from him just to try to support him. I've sent him money, and I've bought a little, you know, thing from a little photograph from the moon where, you know, I think he attaches a little tiny piece of gold that had something to do with one of the spacecraft or so on. But, I mean, it's very, very sad to hear. And, again, and this is one of the things that really motivated me about my choice to do this series of people, is you got to ask yourself, what is the point? Why would you do this if you're going to make $1 million ruining your life? Most of these people have suffered from all this. There's nothing beneficial in this.
It is interesting to just think about, what are they? Are they aliens? Are they a different type of human being? And if so, what are they doing around antiquated technology?
Mm.
I'm assuming that their technology is more advanced, but I could be wrong.
Well, maybe it's not so much what are they doing around antiquated technology. Maybe they're just keeping an eye on the activities of us on the of our species on the edge of our sciences, on the edge of our exploration. Here we are in outer space, and NASA is the place that is supposedly representing our country's efforts to go out into space. And so what better place to show up in than you know, in our activities in space? Speculation, of course, but...
It's speculation, and it makes me think about the two shuttle accidents, how, you know, they were very odd in the way that they happened. But not to digress too much, we should get back into some of the other people that are in the Whistleblower Portrait Project.
Okay, well, while we were touching on NASA, we could go over to Donna Hare. Donna Hare was working for NASA, and she was working with slides, I think. She was put in charge of handling the visuals for the program, and she would go over slides and clean them up and this and that. And she was told and was given the reasoning that she has to airbrush things out of the slides of the moon mission and so on. And she was told to airbrush any kind of UFOs and objects like that out of the photographs. So what was that all about? I mean, why would she be asked to take these objects that are, she said you can clearly see a white dot and then a shadow underneath it on the surface of whatever the angle was for the sun, to know that that white dot wasn't an emulsion, it was something floating above the surface of the moon. There were other people to corroborate this, and a technician that she said that she spoke to. I think when the astronauts come back and they have to kind of debrief them and everything like that, a technician was in there with them, and he said that he had overheard, you know, the astronauts talking about bogeys up there, Santa Claus up there. Santa Claus was a term that they used for whenever they saw a UFO. They would just give it a code name, and they'd say, hey, we saw Santa Claus up here, and that was...
They saw three UFOs land on the moon.
Yeah, they saw them, you know, allegedly saw them on the mountains, on the, you know, on the rim of the crater, these ships. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, our astronaut who went to the moon, is in my project also, and he also has testified to the same. And he has also been a witness to and spoke to most of the people around Roswell, New Mexico. He knew those people, and he knew that they were threatened and frightened and told to keep quiet about what they saw. So there's a lot of very, very top people that corroborate a lot of the information that's out there on this topic. And it's one of those topics that I intuitively know is real. I just can't explain it. I just know that this is real. You know, human beings are funny. We act as if all the information is already in, and we're just creeping forward in technology. Even though we have these computers and all this stuff that we have, we're going to, in another 50 to 100 years, going to be looking back at this moment no different than we look back at the beginning of the industrial age.
Now, Donna Hare, as you mentioned, one of the people in your portraits, she claims thousands of photographs of UFOs have been altered and airbrushed. And that connects to Gary McKinnon.
Yeah.
And he's in the portrait project as well, Doug. Can you make that connection?
Well, sure. Well, Gary McKinnon was he's a young guy living in United Kingdom. He had the skill of a hacker, and he's very curious about this entire topic of ufology and the others and everything. And he successfully hacked into the Pentagon's computers. And he got in there, and before anybody realized he was in there, he was looking around for this type of information. And he found several ships. I think one was called the USSS. He found titles of ships, and he found extraterrestrial officers, a list of extraterrestrial officers working in our Air Force or whatever it was that the Pentagon had, and he found, although he couldn't get a photograph, he found documented evidence to the fact that we have a space fleet other than the obvious fleet that we have. Because when he looked up the names and the ships that he found, he can't, that they're not listed in our standard military. So what are they? Where did they come from? And they made such a big deal out of this young guy that they wanted to extradite him from UK to here and prosecute him. And somehow this got mired and quieted down, and they let it go. But maybe the point of letting it go was because maybe if it ever became public and that conversation became larger, then it would be worse for them than just letting it sit.
I remember the mainstream news about that particular incident, and Gary McKinnon was very fearful. Initially, he was like, yeah, I did it, and it was a mistake, I'm sorry. But later, maybe years later, it got kind of serious, especially during the time when more people were being disappeared into black sites, and Guantanamo was in the mainstream media prominently. And his attitude changed, and he was very fearful. I remember that part of it. Another connection here on this topic are Andrew Johnson and Richard Hall. Andrew has been a guest on this show a couple times, but they're in your whistleblower portrait gallery. Can you talk about why?
Yes. Well, Richard Hall, I came across on my own. I came across him, and I found his show Rich Planet, which he does out of United Kingdom. And he is a fantastic researcher. I mean, here's a guy that goes after any story and every story that he feels has some legs to it. And he'll go into it, and he'll really work hard without a whole bunch of fanfare. He'll go into it, and he'll present things that are really phenomenal, such as, I know, for example, Linda Moulton Howe did the whole thing on cattle mutilation. Well, Rich and a lot of people feel that Linda stops too short because he has a lot of evidence on human mutilation. And it's so hard to handle when you look at the actual photography that he has found. He did a documentary film on this, and it's absolutely fascinating. It's a really, really well done and riveting film, a documentary that he's done on this entire topic. And you just don't want to believe that this is possible, because it's rather, you know, it's rather frightening. But it's not only cattle and cats; it's human mutilation, where the cutting and the type of mutilation to the human being does not make any sense. It doesn't look like an animal or a dog. It's precision cutting. It's almost laser cutting. Organs removed, no blood. So Richard handles every topic you can think of, from the alleged moon landing, which he deeply questions, 9/11, and so on. And Andrew Johnson, who I've become friends with since, Andrew has been on his show many times, and Andrew is also a very serious, very non-hysterical researcher who is willing to change gears if he learns evidence that he has been wrong about something. And that is one of the things I give Andrew a lot of credit for, because if he's onto something and he learns that he's wrong, he doesn't care about whether he's going to stop sales on his book or whatever. In other words, we get caught into having a group of followers and support, and we don't want to be wrong about anything because we're afraid of losing our reputation. He's not. He'll say, well, I was wrong about that. Now I'm going in this direction. Now new evidence has shown me to go into this direction, and this is the direction I'm going to start to look into. And I admire that in a researcher.
And he's friends with Dr. Judy Wood, and he's been on the show last June. It was last year around this time with Dr. Judy Wood's lawyer. But he was visiting here in the United States with his daughter and to view the eclipse with Dr. Judy Wood. And so he also visited New York City. It was pretty cool. We had a nice time. Andrew Johnson also focused in on geoengineering. And he built the Raspberry Pi computer system that connected a camera to this device that also read the transponder information of aircrafts, planes that are flying in the vicinity of where the computer can sit. So you could film aircraft, video recording of aircraft either leaving a persistent trail or not, and the corresponding transponder information. And the conclusions are basically that most planes that are leaving a trail do not have transponder information.
Wow. Now, Andrew came up with that?
He designed it. He sells those devices.
You want to know something? I heard the name, but I never knew Andrew designed that. Mm-hmm. Pretty smart guy. And great person to talk to and be around, a very critical thinker, who has a very, very cool website called Check the Evidence, isn't that it?
Checktheevidence.com. He was a former software engineer and teacher, and he had done extensive research into the destruction that occurred on September 11, 2001, the manufactured wars on terror, the suppression of free energy, and, of course, climate engineering. He now works with disabled students, assessing them for higher education assistance. Dr. Judy Wood is another person in the gallery here. Can you talk about why you chose her?
Dr. Judy Wood is the most fascinating person and serious person, certainly the one who has done the best research on the whole topic of 9/11. Incredibly qualified, and she wrote the book, Where Did the Towers Go? And I happened to be living right outside Manhattan when that happened, and I saw the event happen. I saw what I believe to be the second plane hit the building. The funny thing is when I tell this story, because there's a lot of controversy as to whether the planes were holograms or real planes or whatever, I saw in the distance a gray plane. It was not a American Airlines or a passenger jet. It looked like a gray military plane. And I saw it go down behind, because I remember pointing and going, oh, it looks like a plane is coming to survey the area, like a military plane is going to come and take a look. And then then it went behind the building, and then the second building exploded. So I wasn't sure what that was, but I do remember that. But getting back to Dr. Wood, she does such a fantastic scientific study on this event, with the Earth's magnetosphere and
magnetosphere,
shall I say? Yes, thank you for correcting me.
No, it's okay. Maybe you could just say it again.
Oh, no, I don't mind that. Okay. That's real. Leave it in there. magnetosphere. Yeah, I'm not winning any English awards here.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and, she shows you so many mitigating circumstances and bits of information that add to seriously questioning why, ultimately, I think, Jeff, 7 buildings were destroyed by 2 planes in Manhattan. We all know about Building 7, or at least if you don't know, you should. The Building 7 was never hit by an airplane, yet collapsed in its own footprint. All the buildings fell at free fall speed, meaning that nothing was behind. If you dropped a billiard ball or a bowling ball off the roof of the World Trade Center, it would fall at a speed and hit the ground the same speed as the building did. But the building has tons and tons of material underneath it. How did that building fall so fast? It had to be taken out at the knees to be able to fall. And the pile that would have been left would have been substantial. Yet you see the photographs, because Building 7 is still standing. You can see a famous photograph where there's an ambulance sitting right outside the bottom of the World Trade Center. There's some metal and smoke and everything like that. But there's a small little area of rubble. It actually doesn't add up.
Professor Eric Larson writes about Dr. Wood, and he helped publish her book, Where Did the Towers Go? And he writes, consider the sheer effort that Dr. Wood has made, the years and years and years of observation, study, and research, not to mention the additional effort and time given to the actual writing of the monumental Where Did the Towers Go? Would anyone lacking a sense of or sympathy for the human dimension of the present political moment go to so immense an effort to bring hope and a concrete step toward relief and security to millions of people who are now in harm's way? Doug, you mentioned the building mass of the towers. here are some bullet points from a past interview with Dr. Wood. She talks about the absence of 1 million tons of building mass in the debris pile. The pile equaled 2% of the total mass. The fact of damage to buildings adjacent to the towers appearing only below 18th floor level, and you mentioned this too, Doug, changes in Earth's magnetic field at a time of each building's destruction. Flames that failed to ignite paper, failed to singe tree leaves, and in many cases, failed to harm flesh or burn clothing. The absence of high heat throughout the process of destruction, the absence of damage to the concrete, quote, bathtub under the buildings that is there to hold river water out, the engine blocks of automobiles missing entirely. Automobiles having been, quote, toasted in patterns inconsistent with oxidation. Fire trucks and other vehicles being flipped over with no sign of heavy wind or concussive force have been present. The sudden exploding of objects, people, vehicles, and steel tanks. Circular holes having appeared in glass panes while the panes remain intact. And the presence of thunder on 9/11 recorded at all three major metropolitan airports. The presence of Hurricane Erin offshore from New York City on 9/11, a Category 3 storm that went essentially unreported on news media and that abruptly changed course away from the city after the tower's destruction.
It's staggering when you look at this information, and the cars that you mentioned always blew my mind, because here you would have a car that would have perfectly fine sofas and interior on the seats, but the engine block would be melted. Do you understand an engine block, the inside of an engine under a hood? Do you understand how solid and doesn't make any sense? How is it even possible to melt door handles off of cars and yet have the sofa or the interior of the car be okay, or only half the paint gone on the car and the rest of it rusted in no time?
Dr. Wood had made a major sacrifice. So many people went after her. Just to give you an idea, listeners, again, Professor Larson says, "Why do my own friends and correspondents and fellow writers scorn, sidestep, ignore, repudiate, or abandon Dr. Wood and her work? Why do Paul Craig Roberts, Richard Gage, James Fetzer, and Jerry Mazza do so? Why does Matthew Rothschild at the Progressive Magazine do so? Why the New York Times? Why Amy Goodman at Pacifica? Why Tom Engelhart at the Nation Institute and Christopher Hayes at the Nation itself? Why Noam Chomsky? Why The Atlantic, Harper's, The New Republic? Why Frank Rich? Why Don DeLillo? Why?"
Yeah, and maybe the kiss of death was mentioning something that seems to be such a sci-fi taboo, which is a directed energy weapon. And the fact that a directed energy weapon, which, in other words, will show me it, I don't know what that is. It sounds like Hocus Pocus or Twilight Zone stuff. A lot of people feel that.
It's got a stigma because it's just energy directed.
But, you know, we're not accustomed to hearing something about that because our military doesn't really display. If we had a weapon the way Dr. Judy Wood is mentioning that could do this, think of how antiquated every weapon is on Earth. Why are we even going to war with countries, and why are we even building a military budget that's sapping the strength of the taxpayer to keep a military, a huge, giant military going, if we've got a directed energy weapon that could solve any problem anywhere just by shooting it in one spot and saying, hey, that's it. You know what I mean? Like, this is the technology we have. This has to be not only hidden by us, it has to be known. If it is true, it has to be known by other major governments. It has to be a consorted sort of effort.
I believe it's true. I'm convinced after reading her book and speaking with her, and she does point out in her book, it's scientific irrefutable evidence, meaning this is science. You can't refute science. If this, then this. It's one of the most important books to get, to have in your library. I would highly recommend anyone listening right now.
What's it, like 400 pages or something? It's quite a large.
It's about 300 pages.
Right? Yeah.
800 illustrations.
Photographs are incredible. The illustrations. And can I touch on this Hurricane Erin? All right, I'm living in the New York metropolitan area, and I'm well aware of this media that will make a buck if they can convince you that three snowflakes is going to stop your life. They'll make a hazard out of it. Oh my God, it's going to snow today, or we're going to have a little bit of rain, or the wind, or whatever it is. And of course, it's breaking news. But somehow we have a Category 3 hurricane off the East Coast heading straight for New York City. They're tracking it, and it's never mentioned on the news. And I can tell you that for a fact, because back then I was watching the news every day, and I would go out in the morning on my rollerblades and get a cup of coffee or so-and-so. And I remember that whole week prior to 9/11, I didn't know anything about a hurricane. I specifically remember that. How could I have not heard about a Category 3 hurricane? You know, we would all be warned to run out to Home Depot, get the tape, do your windows, blah, blah, blah. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And then it turned off on the last day. It hooked out into the sea. They could never have known that. How did it go straight from New York City up from the Florida region in the waters and come straight up towards New York City and at the very last second turn out on its own? How did that happen?
Dr. Wood had talked about this censorship of information that a Category 3 hurricane is right next to New York City on the east coast of the United States, and points out that essentially a hurricane acts as a giant Tesla coil and creates a static field necessary for full function of directed energy weaponry. She connects that into her book.
Fascinating. Yeah, Jeff, also one of the people that I painted, her name is April Gallup. I consider her to be a very brave young woman who was working at the Pentagon on the day of 9/11. In fact, she came in and brought her child with her, and I think in a small child with her, and she sat down at her desk, put her baby down, and at the moment she says that the moment she touched her computer button, the place exploded. And she thought it had to be connected to her computer. That was her first instinct, because she touched it and everything went off. And so essentially when she got her wits about her and realized what was going on, and she was trying to protect her baby, she was trying to also help other people, she testifies to the fact that she never once anywhere and she says she was about 45 to 50 feet away from the opening of where that plane hit. Now think about that. And I remember the original hole in the Pentagon is a narrow hole. It's not the width of an airliner. It's not the width of where the titanium engines would be. It's a narrow hole. It collapses in a short way after that, but you can get the original photographs. You can see the original photographs. There's nothing wrong with the lawn. There's no debris on the lawn. And there's a small hole, and what's creating all the smoke is these dumpsters that have these tires that are lit on fire, and they're burning inside these dumpsters. On close inspection, you can see that a lot of the heavy smoke is coming from there. But jumping back to April's testimony, she said there was no luggage, no bodies, no plane parts, no jet fuel. You couldn't smell jet fuel anywhere, and she picked up her kid and eventually walked right out of the front. And that's her testimony. And she was, I think she needed medical attention, and I think she went to the hospital. And I think she later spoke about the fact that the people that were supposed to help her with her health issues and all the other people in the Pentagon, she said the people that were in charge of that actually prevented help for them, actually just muddied the waters on everything. And I think she was also spoken to by somebody about keeping her mouth shut. So this is where, again, I say, I'm not an expert in all this. I'm an artist. I chose to paint people I think are great, that our everyday person is not aware of. We're aware of all our sports, people and all our celebrities, but this is a demographic of people I think people should take a look into. And so if they either went to my site and saw the list of them, even if that kicked off an inquiry inside them to start looking at their own whistleblowers, now they're in this conversation, and I think it would be very valuable.
Doug, another person in your whistleblower gallery is attorney Danny Sheehan. He had served as the lead attorney and general counsel for the Lakota People's Law Project. Much of that work had been in South Dakota, stopping violations of the Indian Child Welfare Act and rescuing Lakota children from an abusive state care system. He's been active in organizing around the Dakota Access Pipeline, but there's more of a paranormal relevancy here, too.
Well, actually, met Danny. He's an amazing attorney for people, for people's rights, and he was involved in the actual Pentagon Papers. The Karen Silkwood case, he represented Karen Silkwood, who is in my series also regarding the nuclear hazards in our nuclear facilities. The Iran-Contra scandal he was involved in. He's involved in a lot of major cases. So here is a Harvard graduate attorney who is also involved in the entire ET UFO question. And he's, I know he is involved with Dr. Stephen Greer, and I know he was involved in the Disclosure Project. Stephen Bassett got involved and created this Disclosure Project, which is quite amazing, that brought whistleblowers forward to testify under oath at, you know, cost of perjury. If they were lying, they were willing to testify. How many people do you know would be willing to testify that they witnessed this or know about that or whatever in the UFO and ET topic? So Danny Sheehan is not only an amazing civil liberties attorney and an attorney for people's rights, but he is also a person who knows that we are holding information back on this topic.
As you mentioned before, it's a pretty brave thing to do, especially if you're established as an attorney, Harvard grad, and you make a hard left into the paranormal realm. Why do you think he did that?
Well, I think it's because it's the truth. I think some people are willing to say, look, I'm here for a short time on planet Earth, and what greater thing than to speak the truth that you know? That is the greatest thing you can do, is to represent yourself as a real person speaking the truth that you know. Maybe the truth that you know isn't the total truth. It's as much of the truth that you can get a piece of. Because if you can't get all the information, if you're not privy to all the information, if you're not holding the whole deck of cards, you can only assume, based on the cards you're holding, what's in the remainder of the deck. Danny is an amazing, amazing guy, and I think he is, working behind the scenes with some of these major investigators to move this thing forward and put pressure on the governments that hold this information back. Because if this is true, if there is a whole reality of extraterrestrial, be it extraterrestrial or interdimensional presence, and this goes back into time and history and in cave paintings and in writings of different religions and cultures, the jinn, the flying carpets, Ezekiel's wheel, anywhere you can find it, these cultures and these people were trying to explain something they didn't have a way of explaining. If you were in biblical times, how would you be able to explain something you're witnessing in the sky without knowing what anything in the sky flying around would be? So maybe you'd call it a chariot, or maybe you'd call it a chariot wheel spinning in the sky with lights on it. I mean, they were doing their best to explain things. You know, and not only Danny Sheehan, but then there's John E. Mack, investigator John E. Mack, or psychiatrist John E. Mack, Harvard grad, who went through a horrible situation with Harvard because they were very, very upset with him for giving serious inquiry into not only the aerial school sighting of 63 school children in Zimbabwe, who all claimed to see and drew pictures of this shiny craft that landed and these beings get out. And all, I mean, try to get 10, 12-year-old kids to all tell you the same story. They drew the pictures of it. It was so riveting, and it's so fascinating a case that Johnny Mack went there and interviewed the kids. And that's an available interview on the internet. Someone can Google that, John E. Mack and the aerial school sighting, and it's a fascinating interview to see how he was completely convinced. He says, I am completely convinced these young kids and these people were experiencing what they were experiencing. What it is, I don't know. And so Dr. Mack got very involved with regression and experiencers being regressed and finding out what they were experiencing. And as to the best of his knowledge, he was a skeptic at first and became a believer in this. So here's a guy coming at it with a Harvard certificate and would have a great career. He goes and he looks into this and he can't deny it. He says, it's too real. This has to be investigated. And then while giving a talk somewhere, I think it was on the West Coast, he was hit by a drunk driver and killed. Was it the UK? It's possible. I don't 100% remember, but
another interesting portrait in the gallery, Doug, is Dan Willis. Can you tell listeners about him?
Dan, I came across Dan Willis by doing some investigating from, like I said, one person, one researcher to another. And Dan has a fascinating website called thewebmatrix.net. I got to tell you, it is the greatest chronology of the UFO topic and the ET UFO topic and the hidden technologies and back to the Vril Society and everything during Nazi Germany and so on. It is the greatest compilation of research material from then up to present day that you'll find anywhere. Dan's put a great website together. He's a Navy guy who was witness to while he was on his ship, hearing transmissions between various factions of his ship and the Navy about this very topic, that they were witnessing something that shot into the sky at an enormous rate of speed. And he took a very, very big interest in it ever since then. To find out the exact story, you'd have to go to his site. I think he tells it pretty well there. Dan is a fascinating guy. I have met him. We have spoken. I was interviewed on a radio station that he does with Jill Hansen called KGRA Radio. And I put Dan on my list of people because he is tirelessly working for outing whatever the hidden material is that's out there.
Imagine what our society would be if it weren't for these people of conscience doing the right thing and bringing what they know to the public domain.
Yeah, another person very notable to mention here is, after what you've just spoken about, is William Binney. I mean, William Binney has been service to every American you can think of here. Here's a NSA whistleblower who was designing the high-tech systems for spying, but not spying on us. I think there was something called Thin Thread that they had developed for what they call collecting actionable intelligence.
NSA Director General Michael Hayden had nixed a highly effective computer surveillance program called the Thin Thread. Hayden instead elected to award a $280 million contract to the private Science Applications International Corporation to develop Trailblazer, a program that ultimately cost billions of dollars and that was deemed by anonymous NSA sources as a wasteful failure before it was finally abandoned.
And also I think what happened was I think they created something called Stellar Wind, and Binney claimed that this is plain old unconstitutional because it was made to collect information from all of us, all our phone calls, all our internet, email correspondences, and everything. And this was a violation. That's what Mr. Binney said was his reason for getting out.
Yes, Doug, imagine the reality that the state propaganda would want the collective American mind to be in 24/7. And Professor Larson has written so much important material about Dr. Wood and about our society. He asks also, imagine what could have happened if Dr. Wood's book became a number one bestseller. What if her book had gained traction back in 2007 and it launched a worldwide shift in consciousness about the events on that day? Somehow the fog of cognitive dissonance lifted and the scientific evidence presented in the book was absorbed by people in the positions of authority, responsibility, and power. And then these people chose not to follow the lies of murderous, plotting tyranny. They stood against the intimidation. They rejected and exposed the real lies. And according to Professor Larson's list, they would include journalists, writers, editors, broadcasters, teachers, professors, college presidents, administrative officers, deans, corporate managers, directors, figures in and throughout government at every level from the White House down to the most junior member of the least significant in Congress. Dr. Wood's work might have been celebrated in exposing one of the biggest cover-ups known to the human race. There might be statues commemorating Dr. Wood in public spaces. But we have portraits.
The arts throughout time has been a source of information, inspiration, and controversy that's very much needed. If you think of how Guernica, Picasso's painting, was an outcry against war, and Goya did paintings similar. The 5th of May, one of his paintings. These are like, you know, at a time when there wasn't this information overload, a painting was a very powerful thing. If you could see a portrait or a painting or a war scene or a scene of hunger or destitution through a painting, it was an amazing thing. But today, with all the information we have, with an internet, with fast life, it's hard to slow down. I make an analogy, sort of the way handmade furniture is versus IKEA furniture. We're living in an IKEA furniture time, but if you go and you see an antique furniture from an estate sale and you go, oh my God, look at the cherry wood and look at the mahogany and the burled walnut and look at the handcrafted scrolled legs of this table or whatever that somebody took the time to make, you definitely look at that furniture different than you look at IKEA furniture, and you definitely look at painted portraits different than you look at photographs.
Doug, how would listeners find this gallery of yours? Is there a website they can go to?
Yes, my website is www.dougauld.com. Dougauld.com, where you'll see right now 40 years of various series of work that I've compiled, The Whistleblowers being the latest series.
Doug, thank you so much for being on In Other News.
Jeff, thanks a lot for having me.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again Monday, 11 p.m. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.